two fairies, and a bride. Why is it that you never see a kid dressed as a groom on Halloween? Their parents chat at the curb. The night is dangerous. Parents are required. Tall ghosts in khakis and down jackets floating behind the children. The doorbell rings. My parents squabble about who will answer it. Then Mom swears and opens the door with a high-pitched, "Oh, who do we have here?" She must have handed out only one mini chocolate bar to each creature. Their thank yous do not sound enthusiastic. The kids cut through the yard to the next house, and their parents follow in the street. Last year, our clan all dressed up as witches. We went to Ivy's house because she and her older sister had theatrical makeup. We traded clothes and splurged on cheap black wigs. Rachel and I looked the best. We had used babysitting money to rent black satin capes lined in red. We rocked. It was an unusually warm, wicked evening. We didn't need long underwear, and the sky was clear. The wind kicked up, skimming clouds over the surface of the full moon, which was hung just to make us feel powerful and strong. We raced through the night, a clan of untouchable witches. I actually thought for a moment that we could cast spells, could turn people into frogs or rabbits to punish the evil and reward the good. We ended up with pounds of candy. After Ivy's parents went to bed, we lit a candle in the totally dark house. We held it in front of an antique mirror at midnight to see our futures. I couldn't see anything. This year, Rochelle is going to a party thrown by one of the exchange students' host families. I heard her talk about it in algebra. I knew I wouldn't get an invitation. I would be lucky to get an invitation to my own funeral with my reputation. Heather is walking with some of the little kids in her neighborhood so their mothers can stay home. I am prepared. I refuse to spend the night moping in my room or listening to my parents argue. I checked out a book from the library, Dracula, by Bram Stoker. Cool name. I settle into my nest with a bag of candy corn and the blood-sucking monster. Name, name, name. In a post-Halloween frenzy, the school board has come out against calling us the Devils. We are now the Merryweather Tigers. Roar. The Ecology Club is planning a rally to protest the degrading of an endangered species. This is the only thing talked about at school, especially during class. Mr. Neck has a steroid rage, screaming about motivation and identity and sacred school spirit. We won't even make it to the Industrial Revolution at this rate. I get hosed in Spanish. Linda means pretty in Spanish. This is a great joke. Mrs. Spanish teacher calls my name. Some stand-up comic cracks, "No, Melinda no es Linda." They call me no Linda for the rest of the period. This is how terrorists get started, this kind of harmless fun. I wonder if it's too late to transfer to German. I just thought of a great theory that explains everything. When I went to that party, I was abducted by aliens. They have created a fake Earth and a fake high school to study me and my reactions. This certainly explains cafeteria food. Not the other stuff, though. The aliens have a sick sense of humor. The Marthas. Heather has found a clan, the Marthas. She is a freshman member on probation. I have no idea how she did it. I suspect money changed hands. This is part of her strategy to make a place for herself at school. I'm supposed to be tagging along. But the Marthas? It's an expensive clan to run with. Outfits must be coordinated, crisp, and seasonally appropriate. They favor plaid in autumn with matching sweaters and colors named after fruit, like apricot and russet apple. Winter calls for Fair Isle sweaters, lined wool pants, and Christmas hair ornaments. They haven't told her what to buy for spring. I predict skirts with geese and white blouses with embroidered ducks on the collar. I tell Heather she should push the fashion envelope just a teeny bit to be an ironic reflection of the 1950s, you know, innocence and apple pie. She doesn't think the clan leaders, Meg and Emily and Siobhan understand irony. They like rules too much. Marthas are big on helping. The name of their group came from somebody in the Bible. The original Martha clan leader became a missionary in Los Angeles. But now they follow the other Martha, Saint Martha of the Glue Gun, the lady who writes books about cheery decorations. Very Connecticut. Very prep. The Marthas tackle projects and perform good deeds. This is ideal Heather work. She says they run the canned food drive, tutor kids in the city, host a walk-a-thon, a dance-a-thon, and a rocking chair-a-thon to raise money for I don't know what. They also do nice things for teachers. Gag. Heather's first Martha project is to decorate the faculty lounge for a Thanksgiving party slash faculty meeting. She corners me after Spanish and begs me to help her. She thinks the Marthas have given her a deliberately impossible job so they can dump her. I've always wondered what the staff room looks like. You hear so many rumors. Will it have a cot for teachers who need naps? Economy-sized boxes of tissues for emotional meltdowns? Comfortable leather chairs and a private butler? What about the secret files they keep on all the kids? The truth is nothing more than a small green room with dirty windows and a lingering smell of cigarettes, even though it has been illegal to smoke on school property for years. Metal folding chairs surround a battered table. One wall has a bulletin board that hasn't been cleared off since Americans walked on the moon. And I look, but I can't find any secret files. They must keep them in the principal's office. I'm supposed to make a centerpiece out of waxed maple leaves, acorns, ribbon, and a mile of thin wire. Heather is going to set the table and hang the banner. She babbles on about her classes while I ruin leaf after red leaf. I ask if we can trade before I cause permanent damage to myself. Heather gently untangles me from the wire. She holds a bunch of leaves in one hand, twists the wire around the stem, one, two, hides the wire with ribbon, and hot glues the acorns into place. It's spooky. I hurry to finish the table. Heather, what do you think? Me, you are a decorating genius. Heather, eyes rolling. No, silly, what do you think about this? Me, can you believe they're letting me join? Meg has been so sweet to me. She calls me every night just to talk. She walks around the table and straightens the forks I just set. You are going to think this is ridiculous, but I was so upset last month I asked my parents to send me to boarding school. But now I have friends, and I know how to open my locker, and... She pauses and scrunches her face up. It's just perfect. I don't have to choke out an answer because Meg and Emily and Siobhan march in, carrying trays of mini muffins and apple slices dipped in chocolate. Meg raises an eyebrow at me. Me. Thanks for the homework, Heather. You are so helpful. I scoot out the door, leaving it open a crack to watch what happens next. Heather stands at attention while our handiwork is inspected. Meg picks up the centerpiece and examines it from every angle. Meg. Nice job. Heather blushes. Emily. Who is that girl? Heather. She's a friend. She was the first person to make me feel at home here. Siobhan. She's creepy. What's wrong with her lips? It looks like she's got a disease or something. Emily holds out her watch. The watch band matches the bow in her hair. 5 minutes. Heather has to leave before the teachers arrive. Part of being on probation means she's not allowed to take credit for her work. I hide in the bathroom until I know Heather's bus is left. The salt in my tears feels good when it stings my lips. I wash my face in the sink until there is nothing left of it. No eyes, no nose, no mouth. A slick nothing. Nightmare. I see it in the hallway. It goes to Meriwether. It is walking with Aubrey cheerleader. It is my nightmare and I can't wake up. It sees me. It smiles and winks. Good thing my lips are stitched together or I'd throw up. My report card. Plays nice. B. Lunch. D. Clothes. C. Social studies, C. Biology, B. English, C. Spanish, C. Algebra, C+. Gym, C+. Art, A. Second marking period. The ecology club has won round two. We are no longer the tigers because the name shows shocking disrespect for an endangered creature. I know I'm shocked. The ecology club made great posters. They laid out headlines from the sports page. Tigers ripped apart. Tigers slaughtered. Tigers killed. Side by side with color photos of Bengal tigers with their skins peeled off. Effective. The ecology club has some good PR people. The football team would have protested, but the sad truth is that they've lost every game this season. They are happy not to be called the Tigers. Other teams call them pussycats. Not manly. More than half the school signed a petition, and the tree huggers got letters of support from a bunch of outside groups and three Hollywood actors. They herd us into an assembly that is supposed to be a democratic forum to come up with a new school mascot. Who are we? We can't be the Buccaneers because pirates supported violence and discrimination against women. The kid who suggests the Shoemakers in honor of the old moccasin factory is laughed out of the auditorium. Warriors insults Native Americans. I think overbearing, Eurocentric patriarchs would be perfect, but I don't suggest it. Student Council is holding an election before winter break. Our choices. A. The bees. Useful to agriculture, painful to cross. B. Icebergs, in honor of our festive winter weather. C. Hilltoppers, guaranteed to frighten opponents. D. Wombats. No one knows if they're endangered. Closet space. My parents commanded me to stay after school every day for extra help from teachers. I agreed to stay after school. I hang out in my refurbished closet. It is shaping up nicely. The first thing to go is the mirror. It is screwed to the wall, so I cover it with a poster of Maya Angelou that the librarian gave me. She said Ms. Angelou is one of the greatest American writers. The poster was coming down because the school board banned one of her books. She must be a great writer if the school board is afraid of her. Maya Angelou's picture watches me while I sweep and mop the floor, while I scrub the shelves, while I chase spiders out of the corners. I do a little bit of work every day. It's like building a fort. I figure Maya would like it if I read in here, so I bring a few books from home. Mostly I watch the scary movies playing on the inside of my eyelids. It is getting harder to talk. My throat is always sore, my lips raw. When I wake up in the morning, my jaws are clenched so tight I have a headache. Sometimes my mouth relaxes around Heather, if we're alone. Every time I try to talk to my parents or a teacher, I sputter or freeze. What is wrong with me? It's like I have some kind of spastic laryngitis. I know my head isn't screwed on straight. I want to leave, transfer, warp myself to another galaxy. I want to confess everything, hand over the guilt and mistake and anger to someone else. There is a beast in my gut. I can hear it scraping away at the inside of my ribs. Even if I dump the memory, it will stay with me, staining me. My closet is a good thing, a quiet place that helps me hold these thoughts inside my head where no one can hear them. All together now. My Spanish teacher breaks the no English rule to tell us that we had better stop pretending we don't understand the homework assignments or we're all going to get detention. Then she repeats what she just said in Spanish, though it seems as if she tosses in a few extra phrases. I don't know why she hasn't figured it out yet. If she just taught us all the swear words the first day, we would have done whatever she wanted the rest of the year. Detention does not sound appealing. I do my homework. Choose five verbs and conjugate them. To translate, traducir, I traducate. To flunk, fracasar, yo am almost fracasaring. To hide, esconder, to escape, escapar, to forget, olvidar. Job day. Just in case we forget that we are here to get a good foundation so we can go to college, to live up to our potential, to get a good job, live happily ever after, and go to Disney World, we have a job day. Like all things high school, it starts with a test of my desires and my dreams. Do I A, prefer to spend time with a large group of people, B, prefer to spend time with a small group of close friends, C, prefer to spend time with family, D, prefer to spend time alone? Am I A, a helper, B, a doer, C, a planner, D, a dreamer? If I were tied to railroad tracks and the 3:15 train to Rochester was ready to cut a path across my middle, would I A, scream for help, B, ask my little mice friends to chew through the ropes, C, remember that my favorite jeans were in the dryer and were hopelessly wrinkled, D, close my eyes and pretend nothing was wrong? 200 questions later, I get my results. I should consider a career in A, forestry, B, firefighting, C, communications, D, mortuary science. Heather's results are clear. She should be a nurse. It makes her jump up and down. Heather, this is the best. I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'll be a candy striper at the hospital this summer. Why don't you do it with me? I'll study real hard in biology and go to SU and get my RN. What a great plan! How could she know this? I don't know what I'm doing in the next 5 minutes, and she has the next 10 years figured out. I'll worry about making it out of 9th grade alive. Then I'll think about a career path. First Amendment. Mr. Neck storms into class, a bull chasing 33 red flags. We slide into our seats. I think for sure he's going to explode, which he does, but in an unpredictable, faintly educational way. Immigration. He writes it on the board. I'm pretty sure he spelled it right. Mr. Neck. My family has been in this country for over 200 years. We built this place, fought in every war, from the first one to the last one, paid taxes, and voted. A cartoon thought bubble forms over the heads of everyone in the class. Will this be on the test? Mr. Neck. So tell me why my son can't get a job. A few hands creep skyward. Mr. Neck ignores them. It is a pretend question, one he asks so he could give the answer. I relax. This is like when my father complains about his boss. The best thing to do is to stay awake and blink sympathetically. His son wanted to be a firefighter, but didn't get the job. Mr. Neck is convinced that this is some kind of reverse discrimination. He says we should close our borders so that real Americans can get the jobs they deserve. The job test said that I would be a good firefighter. I wonder if I could take a job away from Mr. Neck's son. I tune out and focus on my doodle, a pine tree. I've been trying to carve a linoleum block in art class. The problem with the block is that there is no way to correct mistakes. Every mistake I make is frozen in the picture, so I have to think ahead. Mr. Neck writes on the board again. Debate. America should have closed her borders in 1900. That strikes a nerve. Several nerves. I can see kids counting backward on their fingers, trying to figure when their grandparents or great-grandparents were born, when they came to America, if they would have made the neck cut. When they figure out they would have been stuck in a country that hated them, or a place with no schools, or a place with no future, their hands shoot up. They beg to differ with Mr. Neck's learned opinion. I don't know where my family came from. Someplace cold, where they eat beans on Thursday and hang their wash on the line on Monday. I don't know how long we've been in America. We've been in the school district since I was in first grade. That must count for something. I start an apple tree. The arguments jump back and forth across the room. A few suck-ups quickly figure out which side Mr. Neck is squatting on, so they fight to throw out the foreigners. Anyone whose family immigrated in the last century has a story to tell about how hard their relatives have worked, the contributions they make to the country, the taxes they pay. A member of the archery club tries to say that we are all foreigners and we should give the country back to the Native Americans, but she's buried under disagreement. Mr. Neck enjoys the noise, until one kid challenges him directly. Brave kid. Maybe your son didn't get that job because he's not good enough, or he's lazy, or the other guy was better than him no matter what his skin color. I think the white people who have been here for 200 years are the ones pulling down the country. They don't know how to work. They've had it too easy. The pro-immigration forces erupt in applause and hooting. Mr. Neck. You watch your mouth, mister. You are talking about my son. I don't want to hear any more from you. That's enough debate. Get your books out. The Neck is back in control. Showtime is over. I try to draw a branch coming out of a tree trunk for the 315th time. It looks so flat, a cheap, cruddy drawing. I have no idea how to make it come alive. I am so focused, I don't notice at first that David Petrakis, my lab partner, has stood up. The class stops talking. I put my pencil down. Mr. Neck.
Mr. Petrakis, take your seat.
David Petrakis is never, ever in trouble. He's the kid who wins perfect attendance records, who helps the staff chase down bugs in the computer files of report cards. I chew a hangnail on my pinky. What is he thinking? Has he flipped, finally cracked under the pressure of being smarter than everyone? David. If the class is debating, then each student has the right to say what's on his mind. Mr. Neck.
I decide who talks in here.
David. You opened a debate. You can't close it just because it's not going your way. Mr. Neck.
Watch me. Take your seat, Mr. Petrakis.
David. The Constitution does not recognize different classes of citizenship based on time spent living in the country. I am a citizen with the same rights as your son or you. As a citizen and as a student, I am protesting the tone of this lesson as racist, intolerant, and xenophobic. Mr. Neck.
Sit your butt in that chair, Petrakis, and watch your mouth. I try to get a debate going in here, and you people turn it into a race thing. Sit down, or you're going to the principal.
David stares at Mr. Neck, looks at the flag for a minute, then picks up his books and walks out of the room. He says a million things without saying a word. I make a note to study David Petrakis. I have never heard a more eloquent silence. Giving Thanks. The pilgrims gave thanks at Thanksgiving because the Native Americans saved their sorry butts from starving. I give thanks at Thanksgiving because my mother finally goes to work and my father orders pizza. My normally harried, rushed mother always turns into a strung-out retail junkie just before Turkey Day. It's because of Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, the start of the Christmas shopping season. If she doesn't sell a billion shirts and 12 million belts on Black Friday, the world will end. She lives on cigarettes and black coffee, swearing like a rap star and calculating spreadsheets in her head. The goals she sets for her store are totally unrealistic, and she knows it. She can't help herself. It's like watching someone caught in an electric fence, twitching and squirming and very stuck. Every year, just when she's stressed to the snapping point, she cooks Thanksgiving dinner. We beg her not to. We plead with her. Send anonymous notes. She doesn't listen. I go to bed the night before Thanksgiving at 10 p.m. She's pounding on her laptop at the dining room table. When I come downstairs Thanksgiving morning, she's still there. I don't think she slept. She looks up at me in my robe and bunny slippers. Oh, damn, she says, the turkey. I peel potatoes while she gives the frozen turkey a hot bath. The windows fog up, separating us from the outside. I want to suggest that we have something else for dinner, spaghetti maybe, or sandwiches, but I know she wouldn't take it the right way. She hacks at the guts of the turkey with an ice pick to get out the bag of body parts. I'm impressed. Last year she cooked the bird with the bag inside. Cooking Thanksgiving dinner means something to her. It's like a holy obligation, part of what makes her a wife and a mother. My family doesn't talk much, and we have nothing in common, but if my mother cooks a proper Thanksgiving dinner, it says we'll be a family for one more year. Kodak logic. Only in film commercials does stuff like that work. I finish the potatoes. She sends me to the TV to watch the parades. Dad stumbles downstairs.
How is she? He asks before he goes in the kitchen.
It's Thanksgiving, I say.
Dad puts on his coat.
Donuts? He asks.
I nod.
The phone rings. Mom answers. It's the store. Emergency number one. I go into the kitchen for a soda. She pours me orange juice, which I can't drink because it burns my scabby lips. The turkey floats in the sink, a 10-pound turkey iceberg. A turkeyberg. I feel very much like the Titanic.
Mom hangs up and chases me out with the instructions to take a shower and clean my room. I soak in the bathtub. I fill my lungs with air and float on top of the water, then blow out all my breath and sink to the bottom. I put my head underwater to listen to my heartbeat.
The phone rings again. Emergency number two.
By the time I'm dressed, the parades are over and Dad is watching football. Confectioner's sugar dusts the stubble on his face. I don't like it when he bums around the house on holidays. I like my dad clean-shaven and wearing a suit. He motions for me to get out of the way so he can see the screen.
Mom is on the phone. Emergency number three.
The long curly cord snakes around and around her thin body, like a rope tying her to the stake. Two drumstick tips poke out of an enormous pot of boiling water. She is boiling the frozen turkey.
It's too big for the microwave, she explains. It will be thawed soon.
She puts a finger in her free ear to concentrate on what the phone is telling her. I take a plain donut from the bag and go back to my room. Three magazines later, my parents are arguing. Not a rip-roarer, a simmering argument, a few bubbles splashing on the stove. I want another donut, but don't feel like wading through the fight to get it. They retreat to their corners when the phone rings again. Here's my chance. Mom has the phone to her ear when I walk in the kitchen, but she isn't listening to it. She rubs the steam from the window and stares into the backyard. I join her at the sink. Dad strides across the backyard wearing an oven mitt and carrying the steaming turkey by one leg.
He said it would take hours to thaw, mutters Mom.
A tiny voice squeaks from the receiver.
No, not you, Ted, she tells the phone.
Dad lays the turkey on the chopping block and picks up his hatchet.
Whack!
The hatchet sticks in the frozen turkey flesh. He saws back and forth.
Whack!
A slice of frozen turkey slides to the ground. He picks it up and waves it at the window. Mom turns her back to him and tells Ted she's on her way. After Mom leaves for the store, Dad takes over the dinner. It's the principle of the thing. If he gripes about the way she handled Thanksgiving, then he has to prove he can do a better job. He brings in the butcher dirty meat and washes it in the sink with detergent and hot water. He rinses off his hatchet.
Dad. Just like the old days, right, Melly? Fella goes out into the woods and brings home dinner. This isn't so difficult. Cooking just requires some organization and the ability to read. Now get me the bread. I'm gonna make real stuffing the way my mother used to. You don't need to help. Why don't you do some homework, maybe some extra credit work to pull those grades up? I'll call you when dinner is ready.
I think about studying, but it's a holiday, so I park myself on the living room couch and watch an old movie instead. I smell smoke twice, wince when glass shatters on the floor, and listen in on the other phone to his conversation with the turkey hotline lady. She says turkey soup is the best part of Thanksgiving anyway. He calls me into the kitchen an hour later, with the fake enthusiasm of a father who has screwed up big time. Bones are heaped on the cutting board. A pot of glue boils on the stove. Bits of gray, green, and yellow roll in the burping white paste.
Dad. It's supposed to be soup.
Me.
Silence.
Dad.
It tasted a bit watery, so I kept adding thickener. I put in some corn and peas.
Me.
Silence.
Dad, pulling wallet from his back pocket.
Call for pizza. I'll get rid of this.
I order double cheese, double mushroom. Dad buries the soup in the backyard next to our dead beagle, Ariel.
Wishbone.
I want to make a memorial for our turkey. Never has a bird been so tortured to provide such a lousy dinner. I dig the bones out of the trash and bring them to art class. Mr. Freeman is thrilled. He tells me to work on the bird, but keep thinking tree.
Mr. Freeman.
You are on fire, Melinda. I can see it in your eyes. You are caught up in the meaning, in the subjectivity of the effect of commercialism on this holiday. This is wonderful. Wonderful. Be the bird. You are the bird. Sacrifice yourself to abandon family values and canned yams.
Whatever. At first, I want to glue the bones together in a heap like firewood. Get it? Tree? Firewood? But Mr. Freeman sighs. I can do better, he says. I arrange the bones on a black piece of paper and try to draw a turkey around it. I don't need Mr. Freeman to tell me it stinks. By this point, he has thrown himself back into his own painting and has forgotten we exist. He is working on a huge canvas. It started out bleak, a gutted building along a gray road on a rainy day. He spent a week painting dirty coins on the sidewalk, sweating to get them just right. He painted the faces of school board members peering out the windows of the building. Then he put bars on the windows and turned the building into a prison. His canvas is better than TV, because you never know what is going to happen next. I crumple the paper and lay out the bones on the table. Melinda Sordino, anthropologist. I have unearthed the remains of a hideous sacrifice. The bell rings and I look at Mr. Freeman with puppy dog eyes. He says he'll call my Spanish teacher with some kind of excuse. I can stay for another class period. When Ivy hears this, she begs permission to stay late too. She's trying to conquer her fear of clowns. She's constructing some weird sculpture, a mask behind a clown's face. Mr. Freeman says yes to Ivy too. She waggles her eyebrows at me and grins. By the time I figure out that this might be a good time to say something friendly to her, she is back at work. I glue the bones to a block of wood, arranging the skeleton like a museum exhibit. I find knives and forks in the odds and ends bin and glue them so it looks like they are attacking the bones. I take a step back. It isn't quite done. I rummage in the bin again and find a half-melted palm tree from a Lego set. It'll do. Mr. Freeman hangs on to everything a normal person would throw out. Happy Meal toys, lost playing cards, grocery store receipts, keys, dolls, a salt shaker, trains. How does he know this stuff could be art? I pop the head off a Barbie doll and set it inside the turkey's body. That feels right. Ivy walks past and looks. She arches her left eyebrow and nods. I wave my hand, and Mr. Freeman comes over to inspect. He almost faints with delight. Mr. Freeman. Excellent! Excellent! What does this say to you? Darn, I didn't know there would be a quiz. I clear my throat. I can't get any words out. It is too dry. I try again with a little cough. Mr. Freeman. Sore throat? Don't worry, it's going around. Want me to tell you what I see? I nod in relief. I see a girl caught in the remains of a holiday gone bad, with her flesh picked off day after day as the carcass dries out. The knife and fork are obviously middle-class sensibilities. The palm tree is a nice touch. A broken dream, perhaps? Plastic honeymoon? Deserted island? Oh, if you put it in a slice of pumpkin pie, it could be a deserted island. I laugh in spite of myself. I'm getting the hang of this. While Ivy and Mr. Freeman watch, I reach in and pluck out the Barbie head. I set it on top of the bony carcass. There is no place for the palm tree. I toss that aside. I move the knife and fork so they look like legs. I place a piece of tape over Barbie's mouth. Me. Do you have any twigs? Little branches? I could use them to make the arms. Ivy opens her mouth to say something, then closes it again. Mr. Freeman studies my homely project. He doesn't say anything, and I'm afraid he's pissed that I took out the palm tree. Ivy tries again. It's scary, she says, in a weird way. Not clown scary. How do I say this? Like you don't want to look at it too long. Good job, Mel. That's not the reaction I was hoping for, but I guess it was positive. She could have turned her nose up or ignored me, but she didn't. Mr. Freeman taps his chin. He looks way too serious to be an art teacher. He's making me nervous. Mr. Freeman. This has meaning. Pain. The bell rings. I leave before he can say more.
Peeled and cored. We are studying fruit in biology. Miss Keene has spent a week teaching us the finer points of stamens and pistils, seed pods and flowers. The earth has frozen. It snows lightly at night, but Ms. Keene is determined to keep spring alive in her classroom. The back row sleeps until she points out that apple trees need bees to reproduce. Reproduce is a trigger word for the back row. They have figured out it is related to sex. The lecture on pistils and stamens turns into a big ha-ha. Ms. Keene has been teaching since the Middle Ages. It would take more than a row full of overheated hypothalami? To distract her from the day's lesson. She calmly proceeds to the hands-on portion of the lab. Apples. We each get a Rome or a Cortland or a Macintosh and a plastic knife. We are instructed to dissect. The back row holds sword fights. Ms. Keene silently writes their names on the blackboard along with their current grade. She takes 1 point off for every minute the sword fight continues. They go from low B's to very low C's before they figure out what is going on. They howl. Back row. That's not fair. You can't do that to us. You didn't give us a chance. She takes off another point. They saw their apples. Mutter, mutter, curse, curse, old cow, stupid teacher. David Petrakis, my lab partner, cuts his apple into 8 equal wedges. He doesn't say a word. He's in the middle of a pre-med week. David can't make up his mind between pre-med and pre-law. 9th grade is a minor inconvenience to him, a Zit Cream commercial before the feature film of life. Apple smell soaks the air. One time when I was little, my parents took me to an orchard. Daddy set me high in an apple tree. It was like falling up into a storybook, yummy and red and leaf and the branch not shaking a bit. Bees bumbled through the air, so stuffed with apple they couldn't be bothered to sting me. The sun warmed my hair, and a wind pushed my mother into my father's arms, and all the apple-picking parents and children smiled for a long, long minute. That's how biology class smells. I bite my apple. White teeth, red apple, hard juice, deep bite. David sputters. David, you're not supposed to do that. She'll kill you. You're supposed to cut it. Didn't you even listen? You'll lose points. Clearly, David missed the apple tree sitting requirement of childhood. I cut the rest of my apple into 4 fat pieces. My apple has 12 seeds. One of the seeds has split its shell and reaches a white hand upward. An apple tree growing from an apple seed growing in an apple. I show the little plant seed to Ms. Keene. She gives me extra credit. David rolls his eyes. Biology is so cool. First Amendment, Second Verse. Rebellion is in the air. We only have a week left before winter break. Students are getting away with murder, and the staff is too worn out to care. I hear rumors of eggnog in the faculty lounge. This revolutionary spirit is even breaking out in social studies class. David Petrakis is fighting back about the freedom to speak thing. I get to class on time. I don't dare use a stolen late pass with Mr. Neck. David takes a seat in the front row and sets a tape recorder on his desk. As Mr. Neck opens his mouth to speak, David presses the play and record buttons at the same time, like a pianist hitting an opening chord. Mr. Neck teaches the class straight. We are galloping toward the Revolutionary War. He writes, "No taxation without representation," on the board. Very cool rhyming slogan. Too bad they didn't have bumper stickers back then. The colonists wanted a voice in the British Parliament. No one in power would listen to their complaints. The lecture is going to sound great on the tape. Mr. Neck has prepared notes and everything. His voice is as smooth as a new poured road. No bumps. The tape will not be able to pick up the angry gleam in Mr. Neck's eyes, though. He glares at David the whole time he's speaking. If a teacher stared murder at me for 48 minutes, I'd turn into a puddle of melted jello. David stares back. The school office is the best place to go for gossip.
I overhear the soundbite about the Petrakis' lawyer while I wait for another lecture from my guidance counselor about not living up to my potential. How does she know what my potential is? Potential for what? When she talks, blah, blah, I usually count the dots in her ceiling tiles. The guidance counselor is late today, so I sit, invisible, in the red plastic chair while the secretary brings a PTA volunteer up to warp speed on the Petrakis thing. David's parents have hired a big, nasty, expensive lawyer. He is threatening to sue the school district and Mr. Neck for everything from incompetence to civil rights violations. David's tape recorder is allowed in class to document potential future violations. The secretary doesn't sound too upset at the idea that Mr. Neck could get canned. I bet she knows him personally. David must have mentioned the hairy eyeball treatment to his lawyer that afternoon, because the next day there's a video camera set up in the back of class. David Petrakis is my hero. Wombats rule. I let Heather talk me into going to the winter assembly. She hates sitting alone almost as much as I do. The Marthas have not issued an imperial invitation for her to sit with them. She's bummed, but she tries not to show it. In perfect Martha style, she wears a green sweater with a huge Santa face on it, red leggings, and fluffy boots. Too perfect. I refuse to wear anything seasonal. Heather gives me my Christmas present early. Bell earrings that chime when I turn my head. This means I'll have to get her something. Maybe I'll go wholesome and buy a friendship necklace. She's the friendship necklace type. The bells are a great choice. I shake my head all through Principal's speech to drown out his voice. The orchestra plays an unrecognizable tune. Heather says the school board won't let them perform Christmas carols or Hanukkah songs or Kwanzaa tunes. Instead of multicultural, we have no cultural. The high point of the assembly is the announcement of our new name and mascot. Principal reads the vote total. Bees, 3. Icebergs, 17. Hilltoppers, 1. Wombats, 32. The other 1,547 votes were write-ins or illegible. The Merryweather Wombats has a nice ring. We are the Wombats, woozy, wicked Wombats, worried, withdrawn, weepy, weird Wombats. We pass Raven cheerleader and Amber cheerleader on the way to my bus. They wrinkle their brows as they struggle to rhyme Wombat. Democracy is a wonderful institution. Winter break. School is out, and there are 2 days until Christmas. Mom left a note saying I can put up the tree if I want. I drag the tree out of the basement and stand it in the driveway so I can sweep the dust and cobwebs off it with a broom. We leave the lights on it from year to year. All I have to do is hang the ornaments. There's something about Christmas that requires a rugrat. Little kids make Christmas fun. I wonder if we could rent one for the holidays. When I was tiny, we would buy a real tree and stay up late drinking hot chocolate and finding just the right place for the special decorations. It seems like my parents gave up the magic when I figured out the Santa lie. Maybe I shouldn't have told them I knew where the presents really came from. It broke their hearts. I bet they'd be divorced by now if I hadn't been born. I'm sure I was a huge disappointment. I'm not pretty or smart or athletic. I'm just like them, an ordinary drone dressed in secrets and lies. I can't believe we have to keep play-acting until I graduate. It's a shame we can't just admit that we have failed family living, sell the house, split up the money, and get on with our lives. Merry Christmas. I call Heather, but she's shopping. What would Heather do if she were here and the house didn't feel like Christmas? I will pretend to be Heather. I bundle up in geeky snow clothes, wrap a scarf around my head, and plunge into a snowdrift. The backyard is gorgeous. The trees and bushes are all wrapped in ice, reflecting sunlight into something powerful. I just have to make a snow angel. I tromp to an unmarked piece of snow and let myself fall backward. The scarf falls over my mouth as I wave my wings. The wet wool smells like first grade, walking to school on a cold morning with my milk money jangling in the tips of my mittens. We lived in a different house then, a smaller house. Mom worked at the jewelry counter and was home after school. Dad had a nicer boss and talked all the time about buying a boat. I believed in Santa Claus.
The wind stirs the branches overhead. My heart clangs like a fire bell. The scarf is too tight on my mouth. I pull it off to breathe. The moisture on my skin freezes. I want to make a wish, but I don't know what to wish for. And I have snow up my back. I break off branches from the holly bushes and a few sprigs of pine and carry them inside. I tie them together with red yarn and set them on the fireplace mantel and the dining room table. It doesn't look as nice as when the lady on TV did it, but it makes the place smell better. I still wish we could borrow a kid for a few days.
We sleep in till noon on Christmas. I give Mom a black sweater and Dad a CD with 60s hits. They give me a handful of gift certificates, a TV for my room, ice skates, and a sketch pad with charcoal pencils. They say they have noticed me drawing. I almost tell them right then and there. Tears flood my eyes. They noticed I've been trying to draw. They noticed. I try to swallow the snowball in my throat. This isn't going to be easy. I'm sure they suspect I was at the party. Maybe they even heard about me calling the cops. But I want to tell them everything as we sit there by our plastic Christmas tree while the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer video plays. I wipe my eyes. They wait with unsure smiles. The snowball grows larger. When I snuck home that night, they weren't in the house. Both cars were gone. I was supposed to have been at Rachel's all night long. They weren't expecting me, that's for sure. I showered until the hot water was gone, then I crawled in bed and did not sleep. Mom pulled in around 2 a.m. Dad just before sunup. They had not been together. What had they been doing? I thought I knew. How can I talk to them about that night? How can I start? Rudolph sets out on his ice floe. I'm independent, he declares. Dad looks at his watch. Mom stuffs the wrapping paper into a garbage bag. They leave the room. I am still sitting on the floor, holding the paper and charcoals. I didn't even say thank you. Hard labor. I had 2 days of freedom before my parents decided I wasn't going to lounge around the house all vacation. I have to go to work with them. I'm not legally old enough to work, but they don't care. I spend the weekend at Mom's store, dealing with all the merchandise brought back by grumpy people. Did anyone in Syracuse get what they wanted for Christmas? Sure doesn't seem like it. Since I'm underage, Mom sticks me in the basement stockroom. I'm supposed to refold the shirts, sticking them with 11 pins. The other employees watch me like I'm a rat, like my mother has sent me to the basement to spy on them. I fold a few shirts, then kick back and take out a book. They relax. I am one of them. I don't want to be there either. Mom obviously knows I did squat, but she doesn't say anything in the car. We don't leave until way after dark because she has so much work to do. Sales have sucked. She didn't get anywhere near the goal she set. Layoffs are coming. We stop at a traffic light. Mom closes her eyes. Her skin is a flat gray color, like underwear washed so many times it's about to fall apart. I feel bad that I didn't fold more shirts for her. The next day they send me to Dad's. He sells some kind of insurance, but I don't know how or why. He sets up a card table for me in his office. My job is to put calendars into envelopes, seal them up, and stick on mailing labels. He sits at his desk and talks to buddies on the phone. He gets to work with his feet up. He gets to laugh with his friends on the phone. He gets to call out for lunch. I think he deserves to be in the basement folding shirts and helping my mother. I deserve to be watching cable or taking a nap or even going to Heather's house. By lunchtime, my stomach boils with anger. Dad's secretary says something nice to me when she drops off my lunch, but I don't answer her. I glare daggers at the back of my father's head. Angry, angry, angry. I have another million envelopes to close. I run my tongue over the gross, gummy envelope flap. The sharp edge of the flap cuts my tongue. I taste my blood. Its face suddenly pops up in my mind. All the anger whistles out of me like I'm a popped balloon. Dad is really pissed when he sees how many calendars I bled on. He mentions a need for professional help. I am actually grateful to go back to school. Foul. Now that there are 2 feet of snow on the ground, the phys ed teachers let us have class inside. They keep the gym at about 40 degrees because a little cool air never hurt anyone. Easy for them to say, they wear sweatpants. The first inside sport is basketball. Ms. Connors teaches us how to throw foul shots. I step up to the line, bounce the ball twice, and put it through the net. Ms. Connors tells me to do it again. And again. She keeps bouncing balls my way and I keep putting them up. Swish, swish, swish. 42 shots later, my arms wobble and I miss one. By that time, the entire class is gathered around and is watching. Nicole is just about bursting. You have to join the team, she shouts. Ms. Connors, meet me back here during activity period. You are going places with that arm. Me. Silence. It is a sad and downtrodden Ms. Connors who meets me 3 hours later. She holds my current grades by 2 fingers. D, C, B minus, D, C minus, C, A. No basketball team for me, because the A was in art, so my GPA is a whopping 1.7. Ms. Connors did not win a lacrosse scholarship by being demure or hesitant. She times me in wind sprints, then puts me back on the line to shoot. Ms. Connors, try an outside shot. Bank it off the board. Have you thought about a tutor? Nice shot. It's those D's that are killing you. Try a layup. That needs work. I could maybe do something about the social studies grade, but your English teacher's impossible. She hates sports. Do you have a hook shot? I just do what I'm told. If I felt like talking, I would explain that she couldn't pay me enough to play on her basketball team. All that running, sweating, getting knocked around by genetic mutants? I don't think so. Now, if basketball had a designated foul shot shooter, maybe I'd consider. The other team fouls you, you get to pay them back. Boom. But that's not the way it works, in basketball or in life. Ms. Connors looks so eager. I like the sensation of succeeding brilliantly at something, even if it is just thunking in foul shots one after another. I'll let her dream a few more minutes. The boys' varsity team dribbles in. Their record is 0-5. Go Wombats! Basketball pole, a.k.a. Brendan Keller, the one who contributed to my mashed potato and gravy humiliation on the first day of school, stands under the basket. The other guys run drills and pass into him. Brendan reaches up a skinny octopus tentacle and casually drops the ball through the hoop. Our boys are unbeatable as long as they're the only team on the floor. The boys' coach barks something I don't understand, and the team lines up behind basketball pole for free throw practice. He dribbles, bounce, 2, 3. He shoots, brick. Bounce, 2, 3. Brick. 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 Can't sink a shot from the line to save his skinny neck. Ms. Connors talks to the boys' coach while I watch the rest of the team hit a sorry 30%. Then she blows her whistle and waves me over. The boys clear out of the way and I take my place on the line. Show 'em, commands Ms. Connors. Train seal me. Bounce, bounce, up, swish. Again and again and again. Until the guys stop bouncing and everyone is watching. Ms. Connors and basketball coach talk serious frown talk, arms on hips, biceps flexing. The boys stare at me. Visitor from the planet Foul Shot. Who is this girl? Ms. Connors punches Coach in the arm. Coach punches Ms. Connors in the arm. They offer me a deal. If I volunteer to teach the basketball pole how to swish a foul shot, I will get an automatic A in gym. I shrug my shoulders and they grin. I couldn't say no. I couldn't say anything. I just won't show up. Coloring outside the lines. Our art room is blooming like a museum full of O'Keeffe's, Van Gogh's, and that French guy who painted flowers with tiny dots. Mr. Freeman is the Vogue teacher of the moment. There are rumors that he'll be the teacher of the year in the yearbook. His room is cool central. He keeps the radio on. We're allowed to eat as long as we work. He bounced a couple of slackers who confused freedom with no rules, so the rest of us don't make waves. It is too much fun to give up. The room is full of painters, sculptors, and sketchers during activity period, and some kids stay there until the late-late buses are ready to roll. Mr. Freeman's painting is coming along great. Some newspaper guy heard about it and wrote an article. The article claimed Mr. Freeman is a gifted genius who has devoted his life to education. A color picture of the work in progress accompanied the article. Someone said a few school board members recognize themselves. I bet they sue him. I wish Mr. Freeman would put a tree in his masterpiece. I can't figure out how to make mine look real. I have already ruined 6 linoleum blocks. I can see it in my head. A strong old oak tree with a wide scarred trunk and thousands of leaves reaching to the sun. There's a tree in front of my house just like it. I can feel the wind blow and hear the mockingbird whistling on the way back to her nest. But when I try to carve it, it looks like a dead tree. Toothpicks. A child's drawing. I can't bring it to life. I'd love to give it up. Quit. But I can't think of anything else to do, so I keep chipping away at it. Principal stormed in yesterday, smelling pleasure. His mustache moved up and down, a radar sweep for all things unruly. An unseen hand turned off the radio as he crossed the threshold, and bags of potato chips vanished, leaving the faint scent of salt to mix with vermilion oil paint and wet clay. He scanned the room for merriment, found only bowed heads, graceful pencils, dipping brushes. Mr. Freeman touched up the dark roots on the head of a lady school board member and asked if Principal needed help. Principal stalked out of the room in the direction of the human waste's smoking haven. Maybe I'll be an artist if I grow up. Poster child. Heather left a note in my locker begging me to go to her house after school. She's in trouble. She is not meeting Martha standards. She sobs out the story in her room. I listen and pick lint balls off my sweater. The Marthas held a craft meeting to make Valentine's pillows for little kids who are in the hospital. Meg and Emily sewed 3 sides of the pillows while the others stuffed, stitched, and glued on hearts and teddy bears. Heather was in charge of hearts. She was all flustered because a few Marthas didn't like her outfit. They yelled at her for gluing hearts crooked. Then the top of her glue bottle came off and completely ruined a pillow. At this point in the story, she throws a doll across her room. I move the nail polish out of her reach. Meg demoted Heather to pillow stuffing. Once the pillow production line was again rolling smoothly, the meeting began. Topic, the canned food drive. The senior Marthas are in charge of delivering the food to the needy, with a newspaper photographer present, and meeting with the principal to coordinate whatever needs coordinating. I zone out. She talks about who's in charge of classroom captains and who's in charge of publicity and I don't know what all. I don't come back to Earth until Heather says, "I knew you wouldn't mind, Mel." Me. What? Heather. "I knew you wouldn't mind helping. I think Emily did it on purpose. She doesn't like me. I was going to ask you to help, then say I did it by myself, but that would have been lying, and besides, they would have stuck me with all the poster work for the rest of the year. So, I said I have a friend who is really artistic and community-oriented, and could she help with the posters?" Me. Who? Heather. Laughing now, but I still hold on to the nail polish. "You silly! You draw better than me, and you have plenty of time. Please say you'll do it. Maybe they'll ask you to join, too, once they see how talented you are. Please, please, whipped cream, chopped nuts, and cherry on top, please. If I screw this up, I know they'll blacklist me, and then I'll never be part of any of the good groups." How could I say no? Dead frogs. Our biology class has graduated from fruit to frogs. We were scheduled to do the frog unit in April, but the frog company delivered our victims on January 14th. Pickled frogs have a way of disappearing from the storage closet, so today Ms. Keene armed us with knives and told us not to gag. David Petrakis, my lab partner, is thrilled. Anatomy at last. There are lists to memorize. The hopping bones connected to the jumping bone. The rivet bones connected to the fly-catching bone. He seriously talks about wearing one of those doctor masks over his face while we operate. He thinks it would be good practice. The room does not smell like apple. It smells like frog juice, a cross between a nursing home and potato salad. The back row pays attention. Cutting dead frogs is cool. Our frog lies on her back, waiting for a prince to come and princess